This month is all about celebrating those who have made a difference in our Berkeley journey. Who's your Berkeley hero? Whether it's a professor, a mentor, or a staff member, you can honor them by making a gift in their name this month. Visit crowdfunding.berkeley.edu and select the Honor Your Berkeley Hero tile to make a donation in their honor. Let's celebrate the people who have helped shape our Berkeley experience.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Berkeley Alumni's Pass the Mic, where we pass the mic to you. My name is Jaquel.
I'm Patrick Farma.
Yes. Hello. What's up, boss? How are you feeling today?
I'm doing good.
Okay, good.
We just went through like the pinnacle of the semester for our office.
Yes.
And so now we're on kind of like a, you never hit a valley here, but you can just kind of go back to business as usual for a little while. And it's really, really pleasant. Like just sitting here doing the podcast, it's kind of feels like a break, even though it's still work.
Honestly, I definitely understand what you're talking about. It's always the spring semester, and it's a certain week that gets us, right? We're like the week before, the week of, the week, and then the week after is just like, ah, it's like a little bit of like a calming feeling, like we did it.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, when we start the semester, it's in the new year, and we don't have our students yet.
Right.
Because they're still on their break. So then we gear up for our students. And then traditionally we have the Los Angeles brunch, which is in February around Grammy time. Usually that's an all hands on deck moment. And then we go right into Giving Day, which is our big fundraising day for the entire Berkeley community. That's in March.
Right.
And then we go into our Alumni Achievement Awards, which is planning an event, usually a dinner. You know, we have to get the alumni in town. We have to plan our media junket for them. We have to figure out what they're going to do, who they get to meet, because there's a lot of faculty that worked with these alumni that want to meet them and hang out with them for a little bit and catch up with them. And then we kind of like, that's the top of the workload for us.
Right
before commencement. And then it's getting everything ready to prepare for the next year.
Exactly.
So that's, it's a lot, but it's a fun semester.
Right. It's jam packed, but it's fun.
At the end of it, you feel like you ran a marathon.
Right. And then it's like, oh, thank goodness for the summer. I'd love our summers. For sure. We were just talking about us looking forward to a nice vacation.
So we got a jam packed show for you today.
Yeah. Everything's jam packed.
Who do we have up first?
So at first, we have our student worker, Leia Galibert, and we have decided just to, you know, check in with our student workers just to see how they're doing and to also give you a perspective of the people that we work with and how great that they are, just to learn a little bit more from our student workers. So we're starting a new segment where we're interviewing them for a little bit. And just a little bit more on Leia. Leia is in her third year, I believe, and she is from Spain. She works on our social media. She helps with the graphic creations for the newsletters, for the event calendars, and she just always is a big help. Brother, you probably have seen her on our TikTok, so make sure you follow that as well. She does a lot of like videos where we are interviewing students and getting the students' perspective on things. So we are just super grateful for her and excited for you to hear this interview with her.
I'm from Barcelona. My native language is Catalan. It's not Spanish. Mm. And Catalan, it's a small language we speak in Catalonia, which is a region from Spain in the north. And I do speak Spanish as a native too. But with my parents, I've always spoken in Catalan.
What brought you to Berkeley?
Huh. Basically, both of my parents, they are Berkeley alumni. So wow. They both studied here.
Did they meet here? Or?
No, they did not. They met in Barcelona, got married, and then 2 years after they got married, they came here together. Wow.
Could we say they met here for our Valentine's Day social media
yes,
posts?
Right. Definitely, yes.
If we gave them a story, would they just go with it?
Yes.
Okay.
Berkeley booze.
Berkeley booze.
Yes.
But yeah, and they brought me here when I was 18 years old. We traveled to the States and we visited a lot of stuff, and they wanted me to come visit Berkeley. And when I went here, I remember I was like, what? I want to be here. I want to study here. I always knew that I wanted to do music, but coming to Berkeley, it seemed like a very far dream, like not possible for me because of the money, basically. But yeah, and then I found out, and that idea of coming just started to fade away as I was there in Barcelona, just doing my life, trying to live from music. And then a friend of mine, a bass player also, because I'm a bass player, mm-hmm. and a bass player also, he got to came here and to come here. And I just, one day I woke up and I called him like, hey, how did you do it? Like, I really want to come and tell me. And he explained me the process of like scholarships and other scholarships he applied to. I was like, you know what? I'm going to try it. Mm-hmm. I was 25, so he was like, it's now or never, I think.
Absolutely. It's always, you know, beneficial to take those leaps, no matter how nerve-wracking they may seem. So how, like, what are your parents saying that you're kind of like in their old stomping grounds? Like, how do they feel? I'm sure they are ecstatic.
Yes, they love that I just took this step. They've always told me Berkeley was our favorite, like our best years of ever, like in our lives. And I'm like, I want to experience that. and they are really happy for me that I'm here. They miss me a lot.
Of course.
And now I miss them too, of course. But they are really happy for me.
Yeah.
And you have like a little bit of a family business back home, right?
Yes. And that's one of the reasons they miss me the most. I feel, because, we started in the pandemic this family business with my brother also. He's also a musician, so for the four of us are musicians. And we started this project. My mom is a singer for kids, but she sings in Catalan. So she's kind of well-known in Catalonia, but that's a small region. And she always tried to put quality music on hands of children and families, because it's not that usual. So that's what we try to do, but more in a global side, because we started doing it with songs in Spanish and in English. Me and my brother just wrote the songs, and my mom and my dad, they helped us in the production and the investment and everything. And yeah, we have this right now. It's very cool. It's called Grow Up Singing. Mm-hmm. And we keep doing it. Now we're gonna start now our concerts. So
Oh, cool. No, it's legit. Like you submitted some of the stuff when you applied for this job. I don't remember being like, okay.
Her social media is phenomenal, like super dope and professional. So I know that
she's
got some great things going on over there.
You want to talk a little bit about what we do, what you do for us here?
Yes.
I'm helping running the social media. I'm helping basically like the post that we need to do, or editing some videos, or just like putting together a couple of pictures with, I don't know, with the Canva, like putting the graphics on there. And just Jaquel helps me a lot, and she's like, can you do this? And I'm like, 100%, and doing videos and having fun.
Yes, Leia is always like accessible. She always makes herself available no matter what it is. Like, hey, Leia, are you able to come here for this really quickly? She's like, yes, of course. Hey, can you come to this event? Of course I can. She's just such a good, you know, like someone great to have on our team, and I'm super thankful. And she's talented. Like, we won.
Thanks. Yeah. I love working with you.
Aw, we love working with you.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of great stuff to come. And thanks for coming in and letting people know a little bit about you. What was the name of your family's thing again?
Grow Up Singing.
Grow Up Singing.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know we always talk about our student workers, but honestly, their work helps us tremendously, and we are very grateful.
I wonder who, if we talk about our student employees more, or if I talk about my daughter more.
I think it's a healthy mix.
So who do we have today, Jaquel?
We have a really good episode today with alum Joel Goodman.
Joel Goodman is a composer, and he has scored over 150 film and television programs. In addition to that, he is his own artist, composer, and mm-hmm. has put out albums. And it's an interesting thing. We were doing the pre-production for this interview last year, and Joel lives in Topanga Canyon, and he said, how about you guys come and while we're doing the podcast, we'll just go on a hike. And I don't know if you know this about Jaquel and me, but we are two city kids, and we're like, sure, okay. And Jaquel, I think you went out and like bought hiking shoes.
Yes, I had to be prepared. I was like, oh my gosh, we're about to hike and then carry a conversation. I hope I could breathe. Like, what in the world? Right? But yes, I definitely went shopping for this. We always need an excuse. I love an excuse to shop.
Unfortunately, we were out there during one of those atmospheric rivers that was happening, and the weather was really bad. So Jaquel and I recorded from our hotel because we were out there for the alumni brunch, and Joel just zoomed in, and we were able to make it happen. He did some ESPN 30 for 30 specials, which are amazing. I love ESPN 30 for 30.
Yes.
He worked on Bad Boys, which is about the Detroit Pistons of the late 80s, early 90s, with Isaiah Thomas and Bill Laimbeer, and just like those guys just used to like wreck people on the court. He did Once Upon a Time in Queens, which is a four-part story of the 86 Mets, which in Boston, we don't talk about that a lot. And we'll just keep moving on. He also scored Being Elmo, which was like has so many laurels, and a number of other things for HBO and other documentaries. And it's something it seems that Joel has discovered as his career went on and really took it and ran with it. I always feel like we're like a movie trailer in the beginning and like we give away too much, but you know, context is important. So
right.
that's who you're going to be listening to.
Exactly. So you have a little bit of understanding of where it is. Now you can understand his story a little bit more when you listen. So enjoy.
People are so mystified by the idea of, wait, you're a composer? Like, you know, like that's, right. That's crazy, right? I had studied music in junior high school and high school. And while I was studying in high school, doing things like four-part harmony and counterpoint and learning all of these things, my harmony teacher said to me one day, go home and write something, write some music. And I looked at him like he had four heads, you know, like, what? What's that? You know? And he said, whatever it is, don't worry, just write something. I think I wrote like a 6-bar, 4-part harmony kind of thing, because that was my language at the time. I was listening to rock and roll and listening to jazz and all these other things. Mm. But from my learning perspective, that was my language. So I wrote that and I came in and he looked at it and said, great, do another. And it was not a challenge as well. Of course, it's a challenge because it's something new to you. But mm-hmm. he was so supportive in it that by the end of the year, I was writing music on my own. Mm-hmm. I was writing things that I wanted to do. I was staying after school with friends of mine who would stay after school to play what I wrote, which was, you know, I look back on that and I think, you know, how lucky was I? And right. and that's kind of where it started. So then you get into bands and you start playing in bands and you're writing music. And it's I feel like it's always been a part of me. Mm. When I went to Berkeley, I came in as a bass major, playing electric bass, but, I was already fairly proficient at it and had been able to satisfy all the jury requirements. So I switched my major to jazz composition and arranging, which opened me up to some amazing teachers. And that's when it really started to get deep and taking it a whole nother level.
Yeah, I think it's always cool when we reflect back on our lives and we kind of see how a path was already laid out to lead to where we are. Like sometimes for me as a child, I would do things as a kid, like perform on church plays and just things that get me ready for where I'm at today to speak publicly, to speak and converse with other people. So starting back in those days when your teacher just gave you an assignment and then to see where you are today, like you've currently composed for over 40 films for HBO projects. And that's amazing, right? Like, do you ever just think about like, wow, I used to be there, but look where I'm at now?
Oh, yeah. This is a pinch me gig. Mm-hmm. Anyone who's able to do these things has to be grateful for
the
privilege of making your living in music, period. That's it. The funny thing that I say sometimes is, yeah, people actually call me up, hire me to write music, and then they pay me. That's like, wow. Like, how does that happen? You know, it's great.
What were some of the scores that kind of called attention to the art of pairing music and imagery?
Gosh, there's a lot. In some ways, the most meaningful ones, I think, are the first ones that we do.
Mm-hmm.
The first film that I scored, there was no temp track, so no musical guide to what the music should be. And it was cut on film. It wasn't cut digitally. It was actually done on a flatbed. So there was a very analog process to it. And in many, many ways, I'm so grateful for having that experience. It became really meaningful for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was essentially a conversation that the filmmaker and I had. And we talked about what the music should be. And then as I was writing it, she would give me feedback. It wasn't notes. You know, I would say it was feedback on like how the music was striking her emotionally. And she never got detailed with it or anything like, you know, I think the flutes are too high, or, you know, this low droney bass thing. Why is that happening? It was always about the emotional quality of what was happening. One of her favorite phrases was, I want it to be more provocative or evocative, which of course doesn't mean anything out of context. But if you know the context of the project and the context of the scene, you can extrapolate something from that. And I could tell what she was looking for. It was also the great learning curve of how do we talk about music?
Mm-hmm.
Talking about music is one of the craziest ideas that exists, because what's happy to me may not be happy to you, and what's beautiful to him may not be beautiful to her. And then you marry it to picture, and then it all changes again. So there's a lot of subjectivity to it. But going back to that first project, I was able to write music for it. It wasn't just scoring to the picture. It was, I think that it is scored to the picture, and I think it does bring the moment of the picture to life. But I think you can still listen to that music as music.
Mm-hmm.
And that set a template for me that I never let go of. In every score that I've ever done, I feel like I've written music. But there are at least a handful of cues in there that someone could put onto, let's say, a CD or on Spotify or whatever, and just listen to it as music.
Mm-hmm.
So in a lot of ways, that film was my initiation. A little bit of a baptism by fire, because most people, you get the project and then it's like, oh, now what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to figure this out.
Mm.
That was a great project. Then there are projects where you get to work with either great subjects or great filmmakers. And sometimes you're really lucky and you get all of that at once. And that's something I think for most people to look forward to. That's how I feel I've been, you know, for the last X years. I've been in that spot where it's been fantastic. And I also feel really lucky because I score documentaries mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that's just really meaningful to me. That has something that I can personally connect to always. I can definitely connect to a rom-com and a horror film.
Yeah.
And a deep drama, don't get me wrong. But this is life. This is real reality.
Absolutely. So one thing I want to point out that you said was really cool is, how do we talk about music? I think that's a really great question to pose. And I'm going to ask the alumni community one time on our Instagram or social media. But I think it's also cool that you were just saying how writing music for documentaries is something that you can also really relate to. So one of the questions I was thinking about is, what inspires you most when composing the music to an individual's lifestyle? Because everybody's lifestyle is different, and the people that you're writing about, I'm sure that, you know, they have their own type of themes going on. So what inspires you to like change up the music style when writing about different people's lives?
In every project you do, no matter what the format is, no matter what the story is about, you need to find something that you connect to in the project. There has to be something that you personally can identify with, that you can speak to, and that you can feel more than anything. How do we want the audience to feel at this moment? I have to write something that makes this person feel that way. Then it goes into a whole nother place because now we're collaborating. Mm-hmm. See, the thing about scoring films is no one does it by themselves. That's not true. You can come up with a theme and you can come up with an idea, but it's going to be based on a discussion that you had at minimum. And then there's probably going to be some feedback. So there always is give and take. Even if that feedback is the cut changed, now something else has happened. And it can get a lot deeper than that, of course. But you have to enjoy collaborating too, which means you have to be willing to go to a place where you're talking about your own feelings about things and be comfortable with that. And you have to play a little bit of therapy in a way, because you're going to have to pull something out of the director or the editor or the producer, whoever's talking to you about this, about their feeling about it. Because they have feelings about this, and that's ultimately what we project. If you think about a narrative film, you know, you have a character that you created. So they all have different feelings about, well, what's the backstory on that character? You know, what was she thinking about here? Or what was he doing when we didn't see him on camera? And in a documentary, it's a real person. And now you have to think about that person and then how the director wants that person portrayed. The key thing here is that you need to be respectful. Mm-hmm. You need to always be respectful of who you're writing for. That's probably true in any situation, but I think very much when you have real people and their lives, you know, are being talked about. And, you know, this sounds kind of could be construed as being, oh yeah, when something serious is going on. It happens when it's fun too. It's, you still need to be respectful about what it is, you know?
Yeah. And actually it's interesting because as you're expressing kind of your interpretation non-verbally, you probably have to think even deeper about the decisions you're making to make sure that you're trying to portray what this character is thinking or desire or things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you're looking for the subtext of the moment, really. You can say, okay, he looks really sad on camera and there should be sad music. And, you know, he just had a tragedy in his family. And that's what the music should reflect. Or that could all be what's happening. But what's really going on in his head is he's thinking about how his grandmother lived her life and that he wants to live his life in a way that honors her and that how inspired he was by her. Those can be two totally different sounds, completely different. And then you can also explain both of those things on emotional terms, totally. One sad and one could be pride.
You've been able to work on a lot of different documentaries. So I'm wondering, do you take a similar approach, whether you're doing a 30 for 30 ESPN episode or the Elmo documentary or a historic documentary, or do you try to think of elements within the themes that you're working in? How's your approach when you start to approach a certain type of topic?
I feel pretty strongly that each film deserves its own unique sound. So in getting into it, things start to be revealed to you about what this should sound like, whether that's instrumentation, whether that's what your harmonic approach is going to be to this, whether it's melody. Melody can play, should play a huge role. And we have many scores that don't use melody at all. And that's possible too. I just finished a score that relies heavily on improvisation. Mm. So you find these different things, and those can really make it unique. And then, of course, things like instrumentation will change a lot. I try to bring a lot of the qualities that I just spoke about to each score. Because my thinking about it and my personal way is I want to deepen the experience for the audience. There are moments when we're scoring things where we need to hold somebody's hand through a scene. Mm. That's great. But overall, I'm looking for things that are going to enrich the story and make it deeper so that when we walk out of the movie theater, we're thinking, wow, we're not thinking, we're just talking. Mm. We're just talking to whoever we're with. And suddenly we look at our watch and, you know, we've had dinner and it's 3 hours later and we're still talking about it. I think music can help make that happen. I think it can help deepen, you know, the story that's there. So that's my approach. And then the other thing I would say is, I think at this point I have my own sound, my own voice. Mm. I think that's expressed whether I'm doing solo cello or an electronica score. I don't draw lines between instrumentation. You know, I'm not saying, yeah, I'm only an orchestral composer or I only do this. No, not at all. But hopefully my voice comes through no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite project that you have worked on?
That's like saying you've got 7 kids and which one's your favorite? You know, or in my case, a little over 100. I can imagine over 100 kids. Anyway,
that would be crazy.
It's funny because I do think sometimes, like, what are the scores I'm most proud of? Mm. Which are the ones that really hit me? And they're the ones where I get to have this experience that I'm talking about, the going deeper thing, and where I feel like I've written something that's really musical, something that people would want to listen to. Mm. So, yeah, thankfully, I've got a number of scores like that. But then when you take those two things and then you combine the third element, which is you love the topic, mm, then now you're that's the trifecta, basically. Right. I got called to score a 4-hour film about Walt Disney.
Wow.
And the guy is fascinating. And that was a case where I really knew his story. I said to the filmmaker, I can't believe you're calling me for this. This is like something I know really well. And I love to do, because he was a fascinating individual. And that was a lot of fun because we got to get into all the little nooks and crannies, you know, what his personality was like, why he did what he did, how he did it. And, mm, yeah, it's a dramatic story, actually. It's great. It's a wonderful film.
Yeah. So work is always fun when it doesn't feel like work.
I always find that people that are really successful in these types of creative works are really naturally curious. And so it's very difficult to get bored.
Exactly. You're hitting the nail on the head. It's all about curiosity. Mm. Mm-hmm. That's what keeps us young. It's what keeps our ideas flowing. It's what opens us to other ways of doing things, other ways of thinking of things, other instrumentation. It's endless. And once you get onto the curiosity bus, there's no getting off. Mm-hmm. It's great.
Yes. Stay curious out there. All right. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how you started choosing to license movies. When we talked before, you were mentioning about like the importance of pivoting. So if you can just talk a little bit more about that, that'd be great.
Right. I have another life where I've also been a music publisher. And that I came up very organically. Two things had happened simultaneously. One is I was owning a lot of the music that I was writing. And the second thing was I had a client who had a big project, a TV series, and was having some budgetary challenges and was thinking about how he could make this work. And that was the first experience of writing some music for a TV show while they were mostly licensing music. Mm. And that opened the door. And then I started going back to what we were just talking about, being curious about music publishing. For me, it was like just fascinating business. And it's a great part of the music industry. actually. It's one of the few places where you can find regular and recurring. That's a challenge for a lot of people in music. So I just kind of started getting into it and listening to what was going on, met with a lot of people, learned more, and slowly the music became more desired. It was, people were calling to license the music, so became regular work. And next thing I knew, I had people helping me to do it because I was busy scoring films and I needed someone else to run that side. I mean, so much of what I do, any composer does, and anybody in business really, it's problem solving. That's the key thing. We start to look at what it is and I go, oh, okay, I've got a little extra bandwidth to do this, and this is really interesting. And you know, and if I remember right, at the moment I finally took the leap to do it, I think that there was a gig I was up for and I didn't get it. And I had this hole in my schedule. Mm. Like, all right, I've got this time. Let me like really dive in here. And then it's like, be careful what you wish for. You know, it's now true. This thing is going and it was great. And I had to hire people basically to help me run that. Good problems, sweet problems to have. Don't get me wrong.
Absolutely.
But I still love that business. I still think it's a great industry.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Emmy that you have won? How did you feel when you received that?
That was a trip. Mm-hmm. That was totally caught me by surprise. Hmm. I got an email from a friend of mine one morning, and all it said was congrats. I got another one, and I called the first friend, and I said, "What was your email about?" And he said, "Oh, you've been nominated for an Emmy for one of your scores." And I didn't even know it was submitted. HBO had submitted this. I had no idea. So I was just really taken by it. Awards weren't even on my radar at the time. Mm. It was really shocking and very happy about it. I had mentioned earlier Irene Taylor, the filmmaker. I scored a film of hers for HBO called Saving Pelican 895. It was about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Yes. And how the brown pelican was already endangered. And this oil spill is now threatening, you know, extinction. Like I said, it just came out of nowhere. And I remember going to the Emmys and thinking, yeah, there's no way. There's no way that they're going to choose me. You know, there's four other people to choose from. It's like, and I'm sitting there in the audience and they call my name and I stand up and then I sit down because I don't think it's me.
Like, there got to be somebody else here by this name.
Exactly. And then it was like, no, it's you. You've won. Go up there. So it's a real honor. Any time that you're recognized by your peers, it's just an honor. It's wonderful. Yeah, it's kind of like a dream.
Yeah.
And even subconsciously a little, that has to put a little pep in your step or give you a little more confidence when you walk into a room. I mean, we've seen some other folks before and after they receive an award like that. And the only thing I can equate it to is when I went from my learner's permit to my actual plastic driver's license. I was like, mm-hmm. All right, I can drive now.
Right. There's something that happened internally, I would say, that felt like, not that I've arrived, but that it's a hard thing to say. It comes back to the recognition thing for me. Mm-hmm. I remember going to lunch with the person who actually sent me the congrats email years and years before. And I was telling him about a score that I thought was really great. And I was expressing some disappointment that it wasn't recognized. It wasn't submitted for anything. I didn't know anything about that stuff. Mm. I thought it was some committee somewhere that looks through everything and picks it, you know? But, you know, here's a guy who has won multiple Emmys as an editor, has cut a good number of Oscar-nominated films. And I'm having lunch with him, and he looks at me, he stops eating, looks at me across the table and says, "What are you talking about? You do the quality of work that is commensurate with that. Mm-hmm. And you work with all the people you work with are all Emmy winners or Oscar nominees or winners. Also, you're there, essentially. And that was a great pep talk, because then I felt like, oh, I see what he's talking about. And I've got to just keep doing what I'm doing. The funny thing is that at the awards ceremony, as I was leaving, you leave with the trophy in your hand. And I had run into a few people I knew in the lobby. And every single one of them said to me, so is this your second or your third? I'm like, dude, it's my first. What are you talking about? You know? So the point in saying that is the perception was already there by mm-hmm. other people. Mm. That's the point. And it kind of echoes what my friend had said to me over lunch, you know? And it's interesting how we get inside of our heads sometimes.
Yeah.
And we limit ourselves sometimes. You know, we've all heard this, like, I'm my own worst enemy.
Yes.
Because that's what happens. And as creative people, we have to step away from that. That's the going back. You've got to be more curious about it instead of judging yourself about it. Mm-hmm. Anytime we feel like we're judging something, even when we're writing something, you know, it's like, stop. And then you have to flip it around and think, wait, why am I writing this? What is happening here? What's coming to my mind here? How, you know, and that'll inform you about something that'll keep you moving forward.
Yes, I agree. Sometimes, you know, imposter syndrome can be really debilitating and keep us from actually achieving the goals that we set out for ourselves, and kind of like it says, self-sabotage. So it's really important. And sometimes it's even important to give ourselves grace, you know, be nice to ourselves and just kind of believe in ourselves that we deserve all the good things to come our way.
100%. Totally agree.
Yes. So as of lately, like recently, you've been working with some young composers. Can you explain a little bit more about like the importance of giving credit to young composers and like how young composers can find opportunities to work with more experienced composers?
Sure. I think as a young composer, to work with other composers is kind of the low-hanging fruit in a way. Because, and I don't mean to say that that's easy, but I think that it's really accessible. Mm-hmm. I think composers are, you know, for the most part, are very open to talking to other composers. And if there's a connection, there's the possibility of working together in some form or another. So I think that should be on most composers' radar, actually, in terms of developing their career. The thing of credit is really important for young composers. It's establishing yourself. It's saying, I've done X, Y, and Z, and therefore I know what I'm doing. The whole thing about working with a director or a producer is they have to trust you. As an example, when a director goes to school to study filmmaking, they learn about story structure, they learn about editing, they learn about lighting, they learn about cameras, they learn how to work with actors, they learn all of these things, but they're not learning how to write music. And they're not learning about, you know, this music goes with this, and how does that make you feel? It's not right. It's just what one person picked. There's no right and wrong. So they may touch on that in school, but are they really spending time on it like they are on these other disciplines? And, you know, they're not. Mm-hmm. So it's important that the composer shows to the filmmaking team that they can be trusted, that they will deliver, that they are professional, that they don't have to worry about it, so to speak, because it's completely out of the control of the director. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm handing my baby over to someone, and the emotional quality of this film is going to change. That happens in every single film. Mm-hmm. Unless the director walks in and says, oh my gosh, you've written exactly what I had in my mind. That doesn't happen. You know, mm-hmm. But it's going to move. It's going to shift a little bit. And they have to be willing to go there. You know, these days when a film is cut, they use temp music, which stands for temporary music. So they're always cutting the picture to music. And to one degree or another, the filmmaker is hearing that music all the time. Mm-hmm. Whether they love it or they don't love it almost doesn't matter, because they're so used to seeing that scene with that music that they can't separate it. Mm-hmm. You can think of famous scenes in movies. Imagine seeing, you know, the scene in Psycho, in the Hitchcock film, you know, in the shower scene, and not hearing, you know, mm-hmm. that stabbing music. You can't, you know, they're intrinsically matched. Mm-hmm. So if a filmmaker is spending, you know, 6 to 12 months editing a film, and they're hearing that music every day over and over, they've got to separate themselves from that. And that can be a challenging thing to do.
Well, you have mentioned like a new documentary coming out with HBO. Is there any other things that you have in the works or that we should be on the lookout for to come out in the future?
Well, I would say the biggest thing for me, if I could be so bold, is my album that came out about 6 months ago.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Congrats.
It's called An Exquisite Moment, and it's co-produced by a dear friend of mine and also fellow Berkeley alum, Joe Martin. And this was an unplanned project. It wasn't like I was saying, oh yes, in September of 2021, I'm going to start recording an album with the idea of releasing it in June of 2023. I had just written a bunch of music, and it all came very quickly to me, kind of percolating in the background for quite some time. I listen to a lot of music. I play music, so I'm involved in it much more than just scoring films. And I'm really also very devoted to the idea of self-expression. Mm. And when we're doing film scores, we're collaborating on that. So it's not a pure form of self-expression. I love being part of the team and I love doing that gig. It's great. But there's also the desire to just write what you want to write. So I'd written a bunch of this music and I called up Joe and I said, you know, I've got all this music here and I know exactly how I want to record it. I want to do this all live, whole band in the studio, record it at once. I don't want to write everybody's parts like I do when I'm film scoring. I want it to be like a band, like we got together when we were kids and, you know, brought in a tune and the guitar player came up with his part and the drummer came up with his part. And I think this is the way to go. And thankfully, Joe said yes, that he would co-produce this with me. And that's when it became real. Mm. And then, you know, we started talking about musicians because casting essentially for musicians became really important. And the first call was to another Berkeley fellow Berkeley alum, Donnie McCaslin. And Donnie said yes, which was a huge vote of confidence and, you know, that he was into it. And we just kept going from there. I spoke to, after that, I think Scott Cully played acoustic bass on the album. And Eric Harlan played drums, Adam Rogers on guitar, and Mino Sinelu on percussion. And then myself playing some keyboards. And that was the basic session. And after that, I started to arrange the music, kind of doing the project backwards. And that was really, really fortunate who have worked with some amazing musicians. Another Berkeley person, John Patitucci, played on one of the tunes. Lisa Fisher sang on one. Randy Brecker, the legendary trumpet player, played on two songs. Philippe Sates, another Berkeley alum, was in there. And Philippe's a dear friend also. So yeah, that was the dream project, the dream projects for me.
We love when alums continue their bonding and relationships outside of school. So to work and do more mm-hmm. with each other is awesome to hear. And I'm sure everyone's able to cherish that, you know, the moment that you all were able to share in these sessions that you had together.
Yeah, it was really great. And I should also mention We recorded it at the Power Station in New York.
Oh.
So it's, yeah, there's a lot of Berkeley going on this record.
Woo! Oh, school. School pride.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, any last words that you would like to share with us, Joel?
Any plugs?
Yeah.
Plugs. Oh, gosh, I get really shy about this stuff.
That's why we're here.
Right. Yeah.
I would just say, you know, follow me on social media. I'm fairly active on Instagram, Facebook, even LinkedIn. I'll be releasing new music all the time. Follow me on Spotify. Yes. And Apple Music, you know, people don't always think about those places as social networks, but there is a social component to it.
Absolutely,
also.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of my Bandcamp presence for those who are into physical product. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's all about self-expression. And I feel like, you know, the album's very personal for me. Mm. It's my personal self-expression. I think when you look at a score that I've done, I think you're getting a lot of me also, and you're getting a whole lot of other influence too, which is great. I'm really proud of that. I've released several soundtracks that I'm super proud of. And in those, I feel like that's me too.
All right, we are back. And that was our episode with Joel Goodman. Boss, what were your thoughts?
The thing that I took away from this the most is, just again, I think I say this all the time, but it's super important. The spirit of collaboration, you know, working with people and having conversations to say, what's the tone? What's the theme? You know, does this character deserve their own musical element, like Larry David in Curb Your Enthusiasm? Or, you know, I loved what he was talking about, When Harry Met Sally. Does Harry get his own theme? Or is the theme only appear when the two of them are together? You know, those types of ideas. And I think it just really helps elevate every project when you can be collaborative. I've been in situations where it's dealing with one person and they can't really see anything beyond what their vision is. And it's hard to work with someone like that because then there's no room for input. There's no room for other suggestions. There's no room for elevation. And so I think Joel really has it down. And not only is he recognized through his awards, but he's recognized through his repeated work. And I think that has to do with the relationships that he builds in the industry, but also the relationships that he builds in each project.
Yeah, I agree. Especially when he was talking about his Emmy, like winning his first Emmy meant a lot because he didn't even like apply for it, or however the process is, like someone did it for him. And it just resonated with me because it was like, it made me think of you and how you like helped me, how you nominated me for the Brassy Awards, how we know how we always go. It's just about like going the extra mile for your coworker or the person that you work with and how much it means. Like, it's just so meaningful to know that you're supported by your cohorts, your colleagues, the people in your industry, and just like to be recognized just means a lot. So I thought that was like really cool and kind of just gives that, you know, that message of like, listen, some people could be doubting themselves, but there's other people looking at you like, listen, this person is doing their thing.
And I don't think there's a lot of incentive anymore to act the way, you know, an industry shark acts. You know, there's way too many different avenues now. You know, it's not top down. There's so many different ways that people can create on their own. There's so many different distribution channels that you don't need to be at the mercy of the person that is maybe not the best to get along with. Which again comes back to what we always say with alumni is you have to be a good hang. You have to be talented, but you also have to be someone that people want to spend time with. Speaking of people that you want to spend some time with, we have the last installment of our Variation Signature series coming out this month. And this month we have Evan Nackamson, who puts on The Candle Room in New York. And The Candle Room is this awesome showcase for artists in New York. He puts together a house band with the best musicians in New York. There's several different Berkeley alumni that either work on the soundboard or, you know, play music or whatever. So it's almost like a late night talk show where these artists come and they perform, and then they have an interview with Evan, and then they do some sort of a musical improv game. So go to youtube.com/Berklee alumni to see that. It's really awesome to hear Evan's story, and it's really cool to see his work. Super bright guy, super collaborative. We work together on this project. And to play us out, we have his song, Waffles.
All right, that's it for today's episode. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for the next one.
Black coffee, I wake up to the smell of you. And waffles, don't worry, gonna taste you too. Loud car horns, won't you sing your songs to me? I'll listen, you're the city birds I need. I used to tread in negatives, they're easy to hold on, harder to move on. Disregard the evidence and the good going on. I'm looking up. I'm living day by day. I'm looking up. There ain't no better way. Dedicate this song to you. I'm happy, I'm hoping that you're happy too. The whole day in wonder of the mysteries unfolding, unfolding right in front of me. I used to tread in negatives, they're easy to hold on, harder to move on. You disregard the evidence and the good going on. I'm looking up. I'm living day by day. I'm looking up. Singing along, no, no, I can't help but singing this song, no, no.